Welcome to the School Sucks Project,
a podcast, YouTube channel, and an online community
dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes,
relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show.
And subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast.
Don't Do Stuff You Hate is also a solution to a challenge that I have always found impossible, which is do what you love. Find your passion. I have found that so hard my whole life to figure out what the hell that is, to go after it. Is this really it? Or am I, I second guessed myself. And when I realized I don't have to do what I love, I don't have to find my passion, as long as I just don't do things I hate, I'm going to move in the right direction. And that's like this giant freedom. You're like, okay, hey, this got a lot easier all of a sudden, because people are like, well, I'm looking for a new career. What do I do? What do you really love? What are you passionate about? And I'm like, I don't know, fantasy football, but like, I don't know how to, you know, you get all trapped, and then you feel guilty. Like, well, I can't make a career out of that. And people are like, you know, people have made careers out of fantasy football, you know? And you're like, oh, I'm such a piece of shit. I'm just not creative enough. Forget that. What do you hate? Okay, I hate this, 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 and this. Great. Don't do those things. What does that leave on the table? And all of a sudden it's like, yeah, okay. It's just like this really freeing component. So there's two sides to the message. And some people start with the freeing part. Awesome, I just don't do stuff that I hate. And then you realize that there's a challenge, because the flip side is it's actually harder than it sounds, because like we're really good at bullshitting ourselves and getting caught doing stuff we hate. So there's a challenge as well. But I think it's really important that you kind of understand the two ways in which that phrase at the title that captures the heart of the book, it has those two different thrusts to it that I think when they come together, that's where you really get the secret sauce. But you need to flip back and forth. Sometimes you need to remind yourself, oh shit, I'm doing stuff that I hate again, I'm compromising. Other times you need to remind yourself, hey, relax.
Brett, welcome back to School Sucks. Today is Friday, April 2nd. Weird day to release a show, but I'll tell you what I don't do. I don't put out shows on April 1st. People are just on edge the whole time when they're listening to a podcast on April 1st, saying, what is this guy up to? Here's another unique thing about today's podcast. It might be the only time you hear one of these conversations as a podcast listener. But every month inside the Un-iversity, picture the word university with a hyphen after the Un-iversity. It still makes me smile. We have many clubs inside our private community. We have a book club. We have a film analysis club. Our most recent film was called My Dinner with Andre from 1981. I got 15 minutes into it and I was like, this film is bullshit. But I watched the whole thing, and it continues to be a kind of worm in my mind. 40 years old, it has many prophetic qualities to it, and it is a real feat to make that premise into a successful, almost kind of like a cult classic motion picture. But this isn't film club, is it? This is book club, and our book this month was Don't Do Stuff You Hate by Isaac Morehouse. So I said to the people in the club, I know the author. Let me see if I can get him into the meeting. Isaac graciously accepted. He stayed with us for about the first hour, and we wind up having a conversation that is just kind of loosely based on the book. But if you are, or you know someone who is feeling stuck in a career, it would really be at the top of my recommended reading list. Oh, I should also mention that the book was co-authored by Praxis COO Mitchell Earle, who I've been meaning to get on the show for a while, so stay tuned for Mitchell Earle. And I should also mention a thanks to Carrie, who is a community member who set up the book club, our very first club, and has now held two monthly meetings. The first was on Nathaniel Brandon's Six Pillars of Self-Esteem. Interestingly, the consensus was The Six Pillars is not the best personal development book of all time, but huge thanks to Kerry for setting this up, keeping people informed, doing polls to pick books. Our next book is called Why We Drive, Toward a Philosophy of the Open Road. It's by Matthew Crawford, and maybe you haven't heard about this, but some forms of your freedom are currently under threat, and driving, like driving in a car, is no exception. But the book, I haven't read the book yet, but I've watched a TED Talk that Matthew Crawford did, and this philosophy is about so much more than just being behind the wheel. So I'm looking forward to getting into that one soon. And I never even finished listing the other clubs inside the university. So we have book club, film club, it's kind of a film discussion club, music club, a crypto club, a documentary club. You might have seen some posts about the 2003 left-wing documentary, Orwell Rolls in His Grave, which asserts that the mainstream media is controlled by conservative forces. Now, that's kind of an obscure documentary, and you might hear that description and go, that sounds like it would be the dumbest thing ever. But we all watched it. We did about 4 hours of discussion based on it, and we found that a lot of the criticisms corporate media made in this film are, geez, even more accurate today than they were almost 20 years ago. So there's audio of that available to supporting listeners. Crypto Club, Do-It-Yourself Club, and Entrepreneurs Club. And all of these clubs will have meetings. Some will be recorded. And as much as there's like that impulse to record everything, sometimes there is something special about that, hey, you had to be there. So if you listen to this and you say, whew, I wish I had been there, there is a path. In the show notes, there is a link. The URL is sspuniversity, just spell that university.com/ideas into action. If you purchase the Ideas into Action Summit, you have access to this community. Use the coupon code MySpace, all one word. That reminds me, as of yesterday, it's been 2 months that I've been off Facebook, 2 months since I froze the School Sucks Facebook group, and the conversation in our University Lounge, which is the most Facebook-like place inside our Discord, is really, really expanding. I actually, starting next week, have to schedule an hour of my day to spend in there interacting with the growing number of folks who are chatting and participating in these various different rooms. Every one of the clubs has a chat. People can just jump on audio and talk to each other if they want. We meet every Sunday, kind of just like a group discussion. People can vent about anything that's bothering them out there in the world. Have you heard about that place? And what I'm trying to do is have one midweek, more structured club-related meeting. So that's what we did on Wednesday night with Isaac Morehouse, our monthly book club. So that's it. We'll get right to it. That link, again, it's also in the show notes, ssbuniversity.com/ideas into action to join our community. Coupon code MySpace. If, final thing, if you are a supporting listener through Locals or Patreon or the AV Club, look at the show notes for any bonus show. There is a special link for you as a supporter to join this community at a discount. You have to go find it. I'm not trying to make this too easy, but the path does exist. All right. The book is linked in the show notes. Also, remember to check out all of Isaac's great work at isaacmorehouse.com. And don't forget about crash.co. If you are someone or you know someone who is looking to launch or relaunch a career, free, of course, of the permission mentality. Thank you for listening. Here we go.
Get all the good life.
Carrie, do you want to kick this off? I think,
sure.
Obviously, we want to promote Isaac's work and Isaac's book, but I think if this is anything like last time, the book is really just a jumping off point for a great conversation.
Yeah. I threw some questions into the Discord earlier. Let me look.
I have them almost right in front of me.
Do you?
Almost right.
I know the first one was, what resonated with you the most? Were there ideas you disagreed with? And how can you put the ideas from the book to work in your own life? So three questions there. So if anybody wants to start.
I will take a backseat on question three because I've already told that story on the show. And it's like most of the story of my career, even though it wasn't made explicit for me by Isaac in whenever that was, between 2000 and 2009. Yeah, I felt like I was indirectly kind of following that path, but I've definitely been over that. And I'd like to hear other people's thoughts on that for sure. I'm going to let any of our guests start. You could even start, Carrie, if you like.
Go, Andrew.
So I'll jump in. Actually, I didn't know of Isaac or anything outside of what Brett told me until the day I met him. And we recorded a podcast with Brett. And my takeaway from that was, man, I love this guy. He just explains everything that I think in a much better format in which I can explain it. Mm-hmm. And especially lately, I found myself being wholly unauthorized to give advice to people, but man, I give advice to tons of people. And so much of what I've been telling people is like exactly what's in a lot of the, you know, blog posts and chapters in the book. And it's fantastic.
So Isaac, you know, and anybody who's on the call who doesn't know, Andrew and I are friends and we have a third friend and we kind of Andrew was counseling him with a lot of this advice that had come out of, you know, the philosophy of Praxis and Crash without really much knowledge of that. Right, Andrew?
Yeah, that was kind of the crux or sort of the talking point of my first conversation with Isaac. I was just like, hey, you know, here's a scenario. What do you think of this? Somebody losing a W-2 job and trying to go for another one. What steps should he take? You know, he's established in this career, but it's sort of a motivation problem. And you know, somebody who I think isn't used to sort of owning their own actions in a way. Yeah, that was really helpful. But lately I've found just sort of, I don't know, whenever I see young people or talk to young people, I just start giving them advice like I'm some old 75-year-old man who's already done everything he could do in life, and that's that.
So you liked meeting Isaac and being like, what would you do in this situation? And you were super gratified when he, as this
career expert, said, yeah, I just wanted him to agree with me.
Yes, yes, it was very satisfying.
Yep.
Well, the word expert always gives me like, I'm with you, Andrew, in terms of like, I don't want to give people advice, but I feel like every time I go through something and I discover that the thing that I sort of secretly already knew in my gut turned out to be really, really true and I should have listened to it, I feel like I have to tell that because I feel like that's universal. And so I tell it, and my writing style tends to be very declarative. Don't do this, do this. This is the way.
Yeah.
That's just because that's the way that I stylistically, that's the way that I write. But I try not to come at it like, let me tell you what to do with your life. I'm almost talking to myself. Like when I write, I write very selfishly and I'm kind of writing to myself things that I have learned usually the hard way. And it's funny when you talk with other people who are struggling with this kind of stuff, you usually know from the questions that they're asking what the answer is that they already know. And what you're really doing is kind of trying to help them feel the freedom to come to the conclusion that is hidden somewhere already inside them, right? To just, I mean, and that's what good people do with me. Like I've met with different people before, investors or whatever, about my company where I'm telling them a story and they're like, yeah, but be honest with me. What do you really think is going to happen? What do you really want to do? Do you really want to keep this employee? And they ask it in such a way where I'm like, damn, I didn't know for sure until the minute you asked it in those words that I already know the answer that I've got to let this person go or whatever it is. Right.
And like when you're up in your own head,
that I want to try to help create for people, not give them something, but help them like discover what they already knew, but they didn't know that they knew, you know, because that's what's been good for me.
Right, because you're coming from a position where you can sort of oversimplify it in a way that just kind of slaps them in the face and wakes them up. But in one of the chapters early on, or one of the blogs early on in the book, you actually hinted at sort of giving advice to people who are going through something that you had gone through in the past, and how you might have less patience for that because it was a former version of yourself. And I always feel that way, and I just want to bludgeon people over the head with advice. But really, in that blog post, you kind of made it clear to me, like, okay, you need to step back. You're not going to convince somebody in one conversation exactly what to do. It's going to be over time. And I'm like, oh, shit, yeah, that's like the next level. Like, you're right. You're not going to convince somebody of anything, especially a big mindset shift, through one conversation, no matter how logical you are.
There's a lot of programming you're trying to undo.
Yeah, so that was like a big wake-up call, kind of just put very bluntly and simply, that I really appreciated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that Morpheus-style approach of like, hey, you kind of know something's off about this, don't you? You've kind of wanted to do things differently, haven't you? Right? And you like plant the seed and then just kind of let it, you know, and if people come back again and say, hey, tell me more about that. Right. Then maybe there's an opening, but yeah, that's been a hard one for me to learn. Cause I'm a very enthusiastic sort of evangelical person and not as in just my style. And it's hard to not want to bring someone from where they are to where you think that they want to be or whatever, all in like, you know, a sentence.
Yeah. Cause I think, well, if you're self-driven, you always want to truncate timelines, right? You always want to take shortcuts or just collapse timeframes and timetables to achieve your goal and you know, achieve that next level of success. So it's really easy to look at somebody else's situation and just think, oh yeah, I can collapse that timeline so easily for you if you just listen to me. But no one ever listens.
Yeah, in The Matrix, he had him on board with the most catastrophic revelation of his life in like 15 minutes. Because they had to get the story going.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, you know, there was some enough backstory. He'd been looking for Neo. He'd been searching for Neo for a long, long time, apparently. Neo must have been dropping Morpheus. Neo had been searching for Morpheus for a long time. So Morpheus must have been dropping clues that people would be like, you know, the right people would be attracted to. At least that's how I like to imagine it in my head. Because, yeah, you're right. The movie itself, that's a pretty blunt and fast-paced conversion story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Does anyone else want to just share on question one there? Which was, again, parts that really resonated with you?
Yeah, I'd like to share. Nice to meet you, Isaac. I really enjoy the book. I actually wanted to share a couple of quotes that I wrote down. I copied and pasted about 13 pages worth of quotes from the book that I liked. I narrowed it down to a few that I thought I'd share for this meeting. Page 27, the martyr, the critic, and the coward belong together, leave them behind. That was probably my favorite part of the book, just because I recognize a lot of martyrs and critics in my life and recognize points where I had been the martyr and the critic. So I really enjoyed that part of the book. Page 33, I believe jumping in with both feet as soon as possible to be always preferable to lots of analysis. I always find myself to overanalyze things and just not taking action. Page 49, when you express the need to combat those who don't agree, you reveal a desire to gain their acceptance and a lack of self-acceptance. In so doing, you enslave yourself to their opinions, preferences, and ideas. You grant them power over your joy. Page 69, the first hurdle to doing anything is knowing you don't need permission. Page 72, there is no amount of parental approval that's worth your dignity, freedom, and power as an individual. Page 92, you don't necessarily have to provide exceptional products. You have to provide products or services that people want exceptionally. Page 107, when people are looking for an escape, don't block the exit. Instead, try to learn why they went out in the first place. Only a couple more here. Page 140, it can be incredibly enlightening and freeing to treat people with the same neutrality we treat our iPhones. Page 182, your reputation is more important to your value in the eyes of others than is your actual product. And the last one that I have here is page 195. It's a paradoxical kind of arrogance to keep your nose in books until you've mastered every angle of an idea, because it assumes that you can master every angle of an idea. So those are some quotes that I really liked. Again, really enjoyed the book.
Is there one that resonated with you more than the others? You're very good at picking really specific quotes. I was tearing whole paragraphs, multiple paragraphs, pages. So yeah, if you have one that we could discuss a little bit, I'd love to do that.
I think the one that I struggle with the most is probably the last one. Is a paradoxical kind of arrogance to keep your nose in books until you've mastered every angle of an idea, because it assumes that you can master every angle of an idea. You know, I tend to read about a subject for a long time before actually taking action on it.
So you feel it's like a form of procrastination?
Yeah.
It's funny, Larry, as you were going through those quotes, by the time you got to the end, I knew right away that you're somebody who can get caught in the analysis trap. By the fact that you picked a couple quotes like that, and just the fact that you found and wrote down so many quotes from the book, you're a studier, right? You're an analyzer. That's a strength of yours. You take things very detailed, deliberately. Like I could sense that, you know, not everybody does that, right? And that's one of the ironies about anytime you put out any kind of content that's about how to take action in your life, it's sort of this weird thing where it's like, well, the type of person that wants to read about how to take action, is that going to keep them from taking action because they're exactly reading about it instead? Yeah. Or is that going to help them? You know what I mean? And again, it's just one of those things that you can get stuck in it, but that's such a, Brad, I would love to hear your thoughts on this, because you're such a studier and I mean, you've studied the art of learning probably more than, you know, almost anybody around these days. That balance between like taking in good ideas feels like it's unequivocally good, but like, how do you make sure you don't get stuck just consuming them? You know what I mean? Over and over again. I'm curious, like, if there are methods to that, because I've always tried to figure that out and I've never quite cracked it.
Well, our friend Steve Patterson had some good advice on that, because you addressed me in this question. I'm like, oh shit, I'm terrible at this. He's gonna rely on me for this.
Well, I'm asking you because I'm bad at the other part. I'm not as much of a researcher and a studier. I'm like a go break things to the point where I act too fast, too impulsively sometimes. And so like, I'm curious, you come from, I think, you're a much more detailed person, more analytical. I mean, just evidenced by the fact that if I record a podcast, I don't do any editing. I just put it out and you like perfect the shit out of it. You know what I mean?
Podcasting is forever, I say. Yeah. Yeah. Steve had some really good advice. So Steve Patterson is a mutual friend of ours. If anybody here or anybody listening doesn't know who he is, he has a book called Square One, The Foundations of Logic, I think, could be the foundations of knowledge.
But knowledge.
He also has a YouTube channel and a podcast called Patterson in Pursuit. One of his concepts or practices that really resonated with me was just zooming in and zooming out. So being able to like see the context of what you're working on, so you know the depth to which, like in breadth and depth, horizontal and vertical, be able to go in and go out and know where you should know the investment you should be doing in any given thing. Cause it is very easy to get lost in things, especially if an action step is coming that kind of terrifies you or that you're even just a little bit apprehensive about. So if you want to get into action, you need to know the depth to which you need to go. I also think like the David Allen stuff, getting things done really helps with this as well. Like identifying next actions. When do I have enough to start moving? There was another book that we talked about on the show years ago. Has anyone ever, I think it was called the 20-hour rule. Who was the person who established the 10,000 hours for mastery?
Malcolm Gladwell.
All right. So the 20-hour rule is like, you would be astounded how much more competent you could be at anything with 20 hours of investment and practice, right? And then if it's part of something bigger, if it's an integral part of a larger project, that might be more than what you need. So when we're kind of putting these composite pieces together in more complicated shows that we've done, one of the regrets is just in the way that I've worked, I think I've just had a surface skim on too many things. And I go through my Evernote and I say, geez, I put a lot of work into this and my depth of knowledge is not what I thought it should be. I mean, I think that's also true. Like, we tend to just remember essences of things. Yeah, I just did a couple of shows with my friend Alex about more intentional note-taking. I don't know if you're familiar, Isaac, with Building a Second Brain, Tiago Forte's
product. Yeah, TK was really into that. And I absorbed the Cliff's Notes version from him.
And that's what I did too. And that's what I've done a lot of. You know, I think my job is to find out a medium amount of information about something and then talk to somebody who's an expert and be a conduit between that person and somebody who knows nothing about it, kind of knowing what I talk about. So maybe that's why I was a little apprehensive about answering that question.
Yeah.
I mean, we could get more into the learning theory side of it, but in my own practice, like, Steve's advice was probably the most helpful thing. And also understanding that you do develop a kind of competence when you're learning about something with the expectation that you teach it to other people. Like, when you're pursuing something new, picturing yourself explaining it to somebody else in a way that they can quickly and efficiently make the meaning they need to make for their purposes, right? So you know why you'd be explaining it to them, and then you know how to give them what they need to do what they need to do with it.
That's funny. I've heard something similar to what you said about 20-hour rule. A friend of mine said a long time ago, he's like, if you pick a subject you're interested in, you read 5 books on that subject, you'll know more than 95% of the world about that subject. Like, you'll literally be, right, an expert. And it doesn't have to be really in depth. And I thought that was really interesting. It's kind of thinking on the margin, knowing how much is enough for your goals. But I will say, like, Larry, you clearly are wired for depth and detail, and don't ever like chafe against that or like think that that's a bad thing or feel bad about that. Cause I think you can figure out how to lean into that too, right? Like, when is this going to give me an advantage that other people don't have? So, you know, it comes down to the goal you have, right? I mean, if you have a pending deadline for a client or a job or something like that, then obviously you got to know when enough is enough to get it out the door. But there are things where continuing to add depth and to know more than anybody else around everything can be a superpower. So, you know, I would definitely encourage you to lean into that where you can, and just find if there's one or two areas where you feel like you're getting stuck in analysis mode. Okay, force yourself to do something to take action, but don't look at that trait as a whole as something that you ought not to be like. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
Larry, could you give an example of somewhere where you got stuck with this, you feel?
Let me think on that for a minute and come back to it.
Yeah.
Recently, please. I was listening to something and like a light bulb went on. I can't remember what I was listening to. Brett, I think you were talking about it. The difference between knowledge and wisdom is action. You can read everything and you can take in that knowledge, but until, like you were saying, like when you teach it to someone, it's like your knowledge of that subject triples, right? So I think that's what the difference is between those two. That was kind of like a light bulb moment when I heard that, that you would, you know, to read a bunch of things and have a bunch of knowledge, that would just be knowledge, but it's not wisdom until you actually put that into some sort of an action.
That's one of the reasons I love, if you put creating before consuming and like flip the, you know, the relationship, because we tend to learn you consume, and then you produce, right? That's kind of how school goes. You study and then you take a test or write an essay. But if you flip that around it has this really, I mean, that's why I love daily blogging challenge, right? To blog every day for 30 days or whatever, something like that. But where I've often asked people like, okay, I want you to write down, write an article about something that you know a lot about. Okay, great. Now do it again. Now I want you to write about everything you know about, right? Like blog every day for as long as, until you run out of things that you know about. And it's really interesting what happens when people are like having to, as Brett said, having to teach, right? If you have to explain something or have to write something, you kind of get to the essence quickly, but you also realize that you thought you needed to keep learning more because you didn't know enough, but you actually realize pretty quickly that you know a good enough to get a point across or to communicate something to somebody. So anyway, I like having creativity force the hand of, consumption of ideas.
I think those things kind of work together too, that I was talking about. I found that book, by the way, it was called The First 20 Hours. It's by Josh Kaufman. And it is very much an answer to Gladwell's 10,000 hour claim. And, you know, I mean, you could even say 10 hours. That book, I think we covered it on the show maybe 7-8 years ago. Maybe you could be more efficient with 10 hours now. And when you have 10 hours of knowledge on something, especially if you're trying to integrate various concepts, 10 hours on one thing and 10 hours on another thing, you can actually start to see how different things work together. And then you can know where you need more depth of knowledge. And that, you know, aligns with Steve's zooming in and zooming out idea. Years ago, I used to like piece podcasts together section by section. Like I would read and read and read and then think about what I was going to say. If it was like something more complex or some historical thing, and then I'd try to talk through it for like 20 minutes. And then I'd stop maybe the next day, do the same process, like go over my notes and go over my notes and try to talk through it. And eventually I just said, I'm not doing solo shows anymore, only interviews. Now I'm not doing shows with less than 8 people starting today. So thanks for being here. But yeah, I mean, that was like piecing, when you had to put a bunch of complex ideas together in some kind of like synergistic finished product, that was how I used to do it. Just take it piece by piece and try to understand one piece at a time enough to know what the next piece in the sequence needed to be.
And I'd be really curious, Larry, to hear what your example might be. And I'm sitting here thinking of one that I encounter a lot. I hear a lot of people wanting to get into real estate and they get stuck in analysis paralysis, right? Because that's a big ticket item, buying a property. Like if you mess that up, there's a lot at stake, right?
Yeah.
But realistically, it's never as scary as it seems before you do it. And, you know, I kind of envy your analysis perspective before you go into things. You're trying to answer a lot of questions that you might get faced with before you jump into something. Whereas I'm the opposite. I just go, well, I don't know what questions there's going to be until I jump right in and I get presented with those questions and I'm forced to answer them.
Right.
But I think ideally there's a balance in between the two. And yeah, I would probably be served well to answer more of those questions first. But again, you could start answering questions that are completely irrelevant. Like Brett was saying,
right,
you know, you sort of portion it off. If something complex, like a real estate purchase, for example, and all the knowledge you have to gain with that, maybe you can dive in on one thing. And it's that first step. It's analyzing different properties, but there's still a million questions to follow. But if you just jump in with both feet, to quote the book, you know, you'll be presented, like those questions will get filtered down to the ones you have to answer. And that's kind of, I don't know, that's sort of my philosophy on it. But I do see a lot of people getting stuck in analysis paralysis. And I don't know exactly ever what to say other than to say, like, here's what I've done. It's worked out okay. And even if I screw up, I will learn so much more from screwing up than I would from reading forever about it ahead
right.
of time.
Right. Yeah, you're very good at kind of getting in there and figuring out what the next problem you're going to have is.
Oh, there's so many problems.
Oh, sure. Yeah, and you find a lot of them. But would you say that your approach to not like overanalyzing things and being action-oriented, can you think of a lot of times where you just really ate shit doing that? Or has it generally been more of a forward momentum?
I think it's more forward momentum because even if I'm going to eat shit,
yeah,
like you don't eat shit all at once, or you have a chance to save yourself, like to grab the rung of the ladder as you're falling down it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
So you don't ever fully eat shit. But every time I take on something new, I feel like I'm about to eat shit.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, some things that I'm going through personally right now, reading this book kind of reinforced my belief to say, you know what, fuck it, I'm going to do it. It's a huge challenge. There's a lot going on. It's a bunch of questions that I can't answer until I dive in. And
well, I was going to say, just so you guys both know, from a mathematical perspective, when people make decisions, like my wife is someone who will overanalyze stuff forever. And then people that kind of make just marginally educated decisions based on a little bit of information, on net, we both work out to the same conclusions on average. So all of the extra studying doesn't really earn you anything. It just kind of stresses you out.
That's really interesting. Where do you, like, how do you know that?
I can't remember where. Me and my wife pulled it up because I was curious about, like, well, on net, why, like, I seem to do just fine with little bits of information. And she'll research something for months and months before ever being able to make a decision on it. And what's actually even more funny is that, so on top of the fact that we both kind of make the same, like, good and bad decision ratio, the science, I'm generally more happy with my decision either way. Like, the people that just make it on little bits of information are usually okay because they realize they didn't waste a bunch of their time. No matter what the person who overanalyzes it does, they're always going to regret something about the decision that they made.
Well, you've said before, more. Maybe this is a little bit controversial, but you've suggested on other calls that you're a little older than your wife, right?
Me?
Yeah.
A year.
Okay, a little. But you said, like, in some like
Brett's going on a little information here. He's just jumping in.
But look at me go. But you have said something like, in some respects, like with personal development stuff, you're a little bit further along and maybe a little bit more studied in certain areas, right?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, I had to get over it quicker because of my career as a musician. Like, you can't be not a little bit more A than you'd like to be.
And I find the bigger your knowledge base is, maybe you can be more successful with less information. If you are good at recognizing patterns that apply.
I wasn't saying this as like using myself as an example. They've done actual studies on it. I can't remember where I read it. I had actually done research because I was curious, like, is there a difference overall between people making like snap decisions and just kind of following through on them versus people like, should I take myself and spend more time doing things like she does?
Yeah. But I'm taking something from your example and I'm wondering if there's a causal relationship there.
Yeah.
Like if a person tends to act more quickly, is it from having a kind of confidence of maybe a deeper knowledge base, more wisdom? So like to Andrew, like if you had a mentor and a person you could always call who was really, really wise and skilled at the kind of things you're trying to do, would that lead to you jumping into doing something more quickly, maybe doing more of a surface analysis, kind of with the confidence that you can find the right answer, right? And you've also done, you know, I know you just drank all this stuff out of a fire hose over the course of like a year or two and learned a ton of stuff. I would think that that would actually embolden a certain kind of like aggressive decision making.
Maybe, but if I spend a lot of time consuming and not acting, I think self-doubt would creep in and I would not act because now I've invested more time and energy and effort into this without actually taking any action. So now when I do take an action, there's more at stake. I'm risking more, right? The action, regardless of my knowledge level, there's a risk associated with that. But the more knowledge, the more time, the more analysis that went into it, I feel like the risk increases. So I feel like self-doubt could prevent me from acting if I wait too long. So I'm really curious, two questions. Larry, do you have an example of you know, a case for you that this is sort of a personal situation? And then on the flip side, Isaac, do you have an example where sort of ready, shoot, aim made you eat shit?
Wow.
And how did you take that? So if anyone has an example in their head.
So for an example for me right now is I've been out of work for a little while and I'm trying to build a new career. So I'm trying to get into business analysis. What I'm struggling with right now is at what point, how much knowledge do I need to develop before I start approaching companies and expect some kind of level of success. And I'm afraid that I'm going to, you know, keep taking online courses, keep studying things, you know, for too long, when I could have actually gotten a job sooner by just getting out there sooner, you know, sending out my resume. I'm trying to figure out at what point, you know, I'm marketable to companies with a set of skills.
Well, I can tell you with a very high degree of confidence, just based on brief interaction with you and based on working with thousands and thousands of people. Well, thousands, I don't know about thousands and thousands, but in getting careers started, you are marketable already. Like, you already are. Now, it doesn't mean that studying and adding more skills won't help, but I can tell you that you have more value on the market than you assume you do for the right person, for the right place. And I would recommend this, and I'll jump into answering Andrew's question. Do both simultaneously. Like, you can, if you feel like there's areas you want to learn more about in terms of business analytics or whatever, keep doing it, but start pitching people right now. Because, you know, Nicholas mentioned acting on low information versus getting more information. Another way to frame that could be what type you, so like, you have a goal, you need a ton of information to achieve it. The question is what type of information and how are you going to get it? So I want to start a business. I want to start a new career. I'm going to need a ton of information to get to my ultimate goal. Is it more likely that the highest quality information is going to be gained by experience and trial and error or by study? And so if I say, well, I need information either way, why don't I go right for the high quality information from the start and jump in? Because the information I'm going to get there is probably going to be more relevant. When I'm studying, I'm kind of guessing what are companies going to value? I think it's this, I think it's that, but every company is so unique. It's like, imagine if you bought a bunch of, you went out and started to buy a bunch of home repair goods before you bought a house. I'm going to buy a house. I don't know what kind of house I'm going to get. I know my budget and I know where I want to live, but I'm going to start buying, you know, caulk and garden shovels. I'm just going to guess at the kind of projects this house is going to require. Like, that's really inefficient versus find the house first. Now you're like, now I know what I got to learn, right? So you go out there and you start pitching companies. Here's what I want to do. Here's my services. Let's go. You learn. They come back and they say, you don't really have what we need. Well, what is it that you need? We need X, Y, and Z. Ah, got it. Okay. Oh, I won't do that again. Now I'm going to go do this, right? I think it's like the information can come quicker almost by jumping in. So when I started Praxis, I kind of did the opposite of, like, a lot of people say, I want to start a business. So what, should I do an LLC or a C Corp? They're researching like the incorporation process itself. And I'm like, that's just literally irrelevant. Like, do you have a product or a service? Do you have your first customer lined up? Like, sell something to somebody, then worry about that, right? But I kind of, so when I got Praxis going, I was just like, yeah, whatever. And I'm like, I went to like my brother who was doing some accounting at the time. And I'm like, hey, like, I'll pay you to like incorporate this. And he's like, oh, I'll pay some lackey who works for me to do it. And they just like set it up, incorporated it in Michigan. I didn't pay any attention to it. Well, several years down the road, we go and we raise venture capital to launch this new initiative, which is now a separate company called Crash. Anyway, long story short, it was hell. And like $150,000 worth of lawyer's fees of like getting this deal closed because I had to reincorporate in Delaware. I had to go, like, everything was a mess, my cap table, all this shit. And I learned, now I know that if I'm going to do something that I think has any chance of becoming a venture-backed model, I will incorporate as a Delaware C Corp from day one. I'll probably go through Stripe Atlas and pay them $500 and get it done like really quick. I know that now. I didn't know that. The thing is, do I regret it? Well, yeah, I regret that I didn't know that. Nobody told me, hey, oh, you're doing something that you might raise money for someday? Delaware C Corp. If somebody would have just told me that, great. But at the time, this was before all this information was so widely available for startups. When I think back, like, I wish I would have known it. It would have saved me a ton of headache and money. However, what it would have taken for me to learn that, I don't even know if I could have. It would have taken me so much time and talking with lawyers and consulting. I never would have gotten the thing off the ground.
So I almost feel like that's the cost. I basically didn't pay the cost up front. I paid it later because I jumped in. And if I would have paid the cost up front, I may have fallen into the knowledge trap where you know enough, you know too much, you know how hard it's going to be, so you don't do it. Right? Like I would have learned, well, I got to have a cap table. What's a cap table? I didn't even know what the letters VC stood for when I started Praxis. So I would have gone down that rabbit hole of venture capital. What do they look for? What's a cap table? I need to have a Delaware. I probably would have gotten stuck in a quagmire of questions and never just gotten the effing thing off the ground. So I can't say that I regret it. Like it would have been super nice if somebody could have just told me that real quick and like just been like, no, I've done this before. You want to do it this way. Oh, great. Because I was like willing to do whatever, right? But because that wasn't there, that wasn't available to me, I had no mentors in my network who knew anything about startups at the time. I think my options were learn enough, slow enough to where I just never start the thing at all, or just jump in and pay the price later and learn through information.
Larry, do you have more?
No, it's great advice. I'll start sending my resume out.
Feel free to email me, for real. Your resume and like, What are you pitching to people? And I'm happy to give you a little feedback and any ideas and thoughts I have.
Crash.co.
Thank you.
Yeah, I feel like we'd be remiss to not
Crash.co
mention Crash. Have you checked that out?
I have not yet, no.
My buddy, you know Joel?
Joel Bine?
Yeah, in our community. Oh, he's been on the show a couple of times. Yeah, he works with Crash. And he's probably, I'm going to try and get him into a Sunday meeting to talk about it sometime soon. It's pretty self-explanatory to go there and get set up, right, Isaac?
Yeah, for sure. And even if you're like, oh, I don't know about sending people video pitches instead of a resume, which, you know, get over that. But I can tell you, we're actually launching, I don't know when this will air, but on Monday, we're launching a daily job hunt newsletter, free, like the Daily Stoke. For anyone who's on the job hunt, it's really short, 6 days a week. You just get in your inbox a little tip, a little resource, a little, hey, check out this cool thing. Hey, here's what you should be thinking about. Just something to get you every morning to check your inbox when you start. Okay, I'm on the job hunt, get in the zone. So that's a really easy free thing to kind of ease you into the Crash mindset, so to speak, which is all about going out there and boldly pitching yourself instead of kind of passively applying to jobs. But right. I don't want to turn this into promo hour.
No, it's just,
but it is about your book. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, it's certainly a philosophy. Related. Yeah. The philosophies of the book and the platform certainly align. So it's a good place to go next after reading the book.
Yes.
On question one, before I enter a couple paragraphs into the record, does anybody want to go on things that resonated with them about the book?
I was going to, just because Larry mentioned close to around one of the quotes that I wanted to read into the record, I guess. If you think that Larry was an analyzer, I read the book and then I journaled about it with quotes. Nice. So I have issues that need to be dealt with by a professional.
I made a 90-minute claymation movie about it.
Nice. First of all, Isaac, I just wanted to say that I saw you and TK. I don't know if you remember me or not, but I saw you and TK in 2014 at Students for Liberty Festival in DC. And I remember, like, you changed my, both of you changed my thoughts about finding freedom in my own life versus finding it outside. I was kind of going there, but you guys just freaking slid me right in and solidified the idea that I had to find my own freedom and that I had to stop asking for it from the state and everybody else. So anyway, I just want to mention that. So I started writing about this quote. Or this one part of the book, it says, you are a victim of and a slave to that which you critique. And so I had been working for this company before I had the job that I have now. I'd been working for this company for about 10 years. And by the end of it, I was in a really bad place. I hated everything about it. All I did was critique everything. And I thought that I could like fix the system from the inside. And it was just really bad. And I ended up getting fired from that job. So I go on to write, there's another quote, "The power of exit is at the core of human freedom. So I say, once I exited that job, it was as though a huge weight was lifted. The problem is I didn't do the exiting. I was fired. I didn't make the choice. It was made for me. And I regret so very much the amount of time I wasted in a place I hated because I wasn't conscious enough to exit, or because I didn't believe I could. I was a victim. My criticism and martyrdom is what got me fired. So in a way, I did make the choice. I only wish I had stood up for myself and my freedom to be the one who exited. Instead, the exit was forced upon me." And then another quote, "Reform is fundamentally submissive and reactive, while exit is empowering and leads to the creative and proactive." And then I said, "Damn, son, you right."
I should mention this book was co-authored with Mitchell Earle. He went through and gathered up all these blog posts that I had written and kind of put them together, selected which ones, edited them, and then he inserted some of his own. And I honestly don't even know for sure. I would probably know if I looked at them individually who wrote which, but I do need to give Mitchell Earle credit. He's got a handful of essays in there as well. And I remember at least one of Larry's was Mitchell. And Mitchell is currently the COO of Praxis. He's running the show over there. So we got to give props to Mr. Earle.
Definitely. Yeah. I've followed your work for a long time. So there were times when I was reading, I was like, this is obviously Isaac, cause I've heard some of these stories before. But yeah, definitely Mitchell Earle. Shout out to Mitchell Earle.
That paragraph actually brought up a lot for me too. And that kind of ties into what I said, the story that I've told on my show before, but if I could just deal with that in full.
Deal with it, Brett. We're here for you, buddy.
"The power of exit is at the core of human freedom. It is the first step on the road to genuine fulfillment and self-actualization. Once you embrace it, and the only way to embrace it is to exercise it, you begin to find paradoxically that it needn't be used as often as you thought. Sometimes just knowing that you are in a situation by choice and could leave at any time is enough to reorient your outlook to a more productive, positive one." I read that and I thought about my experience with my first two jobs. My first two, like adult, not at a video store kind of jobs, right? So the first one was graduated from college, worked as a residential counselor in this boarding school where I went on to do like outdoor education and eventually become a teacher. The second job was in marketing at a ski resort. And coming into the professional world, 15,000 hours of public school and 4 years of college, and the permission mentality that instilled in me, I was so dependent and so terrified. I mean, my like mode of operation at work was terror that I wasn't going to be good enough and I was going to lose my job. And I recently had Cassidy Youngins on the show, who runs an alternative school down in Texas. And we both talked about our experience working in more institutionalized schooling. And even into our mid-20s, we both agreed the function of our job, or our motivation in our job, was to serve everybody but ourselves and the students, right? So that's just like a whole bunch of people who are above you. Public school, you know, that's really serving the system, unquestionably, out of terror. And the same thing was true when I went to graduate school. I mean, that's what pushed me away from wanting to be a public school teacher, was being around them 10, 12 hours a week. And not because they were unpleasant, or, well, they were unpleasant, but they were unpleasant because of what was being imposed on them at work, as they, you know, ruled out No Child Left Behind. And all it was, I mean, these were people who were unionized and about to be tenured, talking about the terror of being watched and being scrutinized as if their job was something that they didn't deserve. and almost the antagonistic relationships that people can develop with their careers and the fearful relationships. Somewhere else in the book, Isaac, I don't remember where, but you're telling a story. It was either you or Mitchell telling a story. Somebody you knew who was like, the people who worked at this company were encouraged to like immediately take their like standard of living right up to the, So I watch my brother do this, except he usually would exceed it by about 30%, no matter how much money he made. The kind of relationship that that creates between, you know, a person and a job is like, you have no options. And then you're spending a third of your waking life in, you know, a self-imposed kind of terror and sometimes chaos and resentment. And obviously that's going to bleed into the rest of your lives. And this is, and how many people live their lives this way? I did it for 2-3 years. And then just by saying, I don't like this, I'm not going to do this anymore. Going from terror about losing my job to not being able to imagine having a job in 15 years is a kind of, I mean, not that I made all the right decisions all the whole way along, but that's a transformation that I'm fairly proud of. It's brought me a lot of like peace and serenity in life. But it really is something about that paragraph. I really just went back and reflected on me in my early 20s living in fear with this deserve-oriented mentality. Like, do I even deserve to be told what to do in this system that hurts children?
You know, it's one of the dangers of, I sometimes call it like the copper handcuffs, because it's not like you're balling, making billions, but right, one of the dangers of jobs where, and this is very true of government jobs, if you have any kind of, you know, you get more pay just for time there or whatever, or it's true of nonprofit jobs as well often, where your skill set gets almost smaller and smaller in terms of its value to the world outside of that one particular role, and your paycheck gets higher and higher. And when anytime you're making above market wages for what you do, you need to be very, very cautious of that. If you're doing something you absolutely love and making above market wages, good for you. If you're doing something and you're like, I don't like this, I'm gonna get out, but I'll stay a little while longer. If you're already making above market wages, it's going to be really, really hard. And this is what, when I worked in state government briefly, I saw people and they hated their life, but they had been there so long that they had lost all ability to create value in the real world for anything near the money that they had slowly accrued in their state job. And I've seen people in the nonprofit sector fall into the same thing. After a while, you've been 15 years in program management at a nonprofit. You don't know how to translate that. You can translate it, but not at the paycheck that you've gotten. And like, I saw that and I'm like, I can see that coming. And I want to be very wary of that. And again, if you love the job, it's perfect. That's the best scenario. Get a paid above market wages for a job that you love. But if you're not sure, it's always good to be very cautious of that and just be aware of like, is what I'm doing increasing my optionality, increasing my ability to go out there and, you know, in fact, being paid less than you're worth other places at or below your opportunity cost is actually very empowering in some ways. So if you think beyond just the money you're making and the exploitation mindset, you think about optionality mindset, that's a great thing to know. To know you get fed up someday, not only can you say, I quit, or hey, give me a raise, and if they don't, you can quit, but to know that you can do that and you can take yourself out and you can get paid more elsewhere. You know, that's a powerful thing.
Excellent. So I know you have to be out of here at the top of the hour, right?
Yeah.
Is there any final words of wisdom that you want to impart on this group or the larger group that we've missed so far this hour, or that you're worried the rest of us will miss after you leave, about don't do stuff you hate?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. This book has been, it's one of those things that once you put it out there, it's like, oh shit. Now everyone knows that I have written a book called Don't Do Stuff You Hate. And anytime I'm like, oh man, I got to do this investor call, I freaking hate these things, my friends are like, I thought you didn't do stuff you hate, right? Like it's a perpetual challenge. So I just want to like say, this is one of those things that like I come back to all the time. Again, I wrote this book for me. First and foremost, because it's like we constantly need to be reminded, and even you extricate yourself from one thing, and over time, that stings accrue, and you realize I'm doing stuff I don't want to do. So it's an ongoing process. And if you cannot beat yourself up and make the process fun and playful and have a laugh at yourself when you're like, yep, somehow I found myself going to this thing that I hate doing. Got to try to work on that and know that you're always going to be willing at it. But the final thing is just, there's two different messages contained in that title and in sort of the thrust of the book. So don't do stuff you hate means both a lot of what we've been talking about. How do you exit stuff that's making you unhappy? How do you find a way to not compromise? How do you be honest with yourself about what you really want and not tell yourself stories and not, you know, and that's, it kind of feels, it's got a little bit of a negative connotation. Like I'm doing bad things, things I hate. I got to get out of here. That's bad, bad for me for doing bad things, bad, bad, bad. Right now that's a necessary message, but that's only one half of it. That's the challenge component of it. There's a freedom component of it too, right? Like that's the hard part. It's really hard to do that. But here's the easy part. Don't do stuff you hate is also a solution to a challenge that I have always found impossible, which is do what you love. Find your passion. I have found that so hard my whole life to figure out what the hell that is, to go after it. Is this really it? Or am I, I second guessed myself. And when I realized I don't have to do what I love, I don't have to find my passion, as long as I just don't do things I hate, I'm going to move in the right direction. And that's like this giant freedom. You're like, okay, hey, this got a lot easier all of a sudden. Because people are like, well, I'm looking for a new career. What do I do? Well, what do you really love? What are you passionate about? And I'm like, I don't know, fantasy football, but like, I don't know how to, you know, you get all trapped and then you feel guilty. Like, well, I can't make a career out of that. And people are like, you know, people have made careers out of fantasy football, you know? And you're like, oh, I'm such a piece of shit. I'm just not creative enough. And it's like, forget that. What do you hate? Okay. I hate this, 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 and this. Great. Don't do those things. What does that leave on the table? And all of a sudden it's like, yeah, okay. It's just like this really freeing component. So there's two sides to the message. And some people start with the freeing part. Awesome. I just don't do stuff that I hate. And then you realize that there's a challenge, because the flip side is it's actually harder than it sounds, because like we're really good at bullshitting ourselves and getting caught doing stuff we hate. So there's a challenge as well. But I think it's really important that you kind of understand the two ways in which that phrase at the title that captures the heart of the book, it has those two different thrusts to it that I think when they come together, that's where you really get the secret sauce. But you need to flip back and forth. Sometimes you need to remind yourself, oh shit, I'm doing stuff that I hate again. I'm compromising. Other times you need to remind yourself, hey, relax. You're all right. You don't need to find the right thing. Just don't do the really, really wrong thing, you know? So I guess that's what I leave you with. And I'm flattered that you guys are reading this book and that you're, you know, taking quotes from it, things like that. It's, you know, it's pretty cool to hear that. I wrote a lot of these many years ago. And yet, when I've heard some of you read those quotes, like some of them, I remember word for word because I remember the state of mind I was in when I wrote it. And, it's been a big, big part of my own journey. So it's awesome to share it with you.
Awesome. So continue to broaden your horizons, discover new things you hate, stop doing them and then find freedom as a result.
That's exactly right. That's Love exactly it. Right. If your list of things you hate is all things you're not doing anymore, then you're probably not trying enough new stuff. So, you know.
I love it. All right.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Isaac.
Thanks, Isaac.
Hey, we'll stick around. Isaac, thanks. We'll talk soon. We'll stick around if anybody else has thoughts that we couldn't get in the first hour. All right. There is another 40 minutes of this discussion where we continue to talk about the book and we talk about habit. And then there's a bit of a transition, right? I raised this question about today's corporate culture. You know what's going on there between all of the stuff that happened last summer, the trainings that people are doing, and of course, all of the corporate COVID obedience, we could call it. And what does that mean for a free-thinking, innovative, young professional looking to find ways around that permission mentality? Has that gotten harder? That transitions into a series of controversial subjects that I thought maybe I shouldn't include, for Isaac's sake, in a podcast that has the title of his book and his name in it.
So that can be found elsewhere, Patreon, Locals, the AV Club. And if you have access, you can look for that at the beginning of next week. If you want access, you can go to patreon.com/schoolsucks or schoolsucksproject.locals.com. Sign up to support us. You get access to that. Every episode of The Discomfort Zone, every episode of Picture of the Month Club, every episode of In Pursuit of Utopia, the highlight reel of our University Weekly discussion groups, going back at this point almost a year. And I know your plate is full as far as media to consume is concerned, but I pride myself, and I also take great pride in this growing team of contributors. You heard several new voices today in creating material that is non-disposable. So if you find yourself, I'm not telling you what to do. I'm not telling you what to do. Consuming a lot of content that is basically useless 12 hours after you watch it or listen to it, we produce, I think, almost entirely non-disposable, evergreen types of shows, and the bonus shows are no exception. And remember, it's that support that keeps School Sucks Project in business. So thank you for listening. I'll leave it there for today, and I will talk to you again next week.
My plane landed. I'm alive. I'm not fighting with the